On this week's 51%, we recognize the 25th anniversary of the Food and Drug Administration's approval of mifepristone, which is now used for the majority of abortions in the U.S. WAMC's Samantha Simmons speaks with advocate Marissa Rudd about her experience with the pill.
I think that it had an overwhelmingly positive effect on my life.
And Rutgers law professor Kimberly Mutcherson walks us through some of the political and legal challenges the drug still faces. I'm Jessie King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jessie King. Last week, we talked about the Trump administration's decision to promote an unproven link between autism and the use of Tylenol during pregnancy. Well, the administration made news in another area of women's health, too, when Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. reportedly told Republican-led states that the Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the, quote, safety and efficacy of mifepristone, one of two pills commonly used for medication abortions in the U.S. Mifepristone has faced multiple legal challenges from anti-abortion groups in recent years, including a challenge to its FDA approval that the Supreme Court rejected last year. September 28th actually marked the 25th anniversary of that FDA approval. For 25 years, women have been using mifepristone in conjunction with another pill, misoprostol, to treat miscarriages and induce abortions early in pregnancy. It has become the main method of abortion in the U.S., used for nearly two-thirds of the country's abortions in 2023. Part of why it's become so widely used is because it's easy to use. It can be prescribed via telehealth, delivered through the mail, and taken at home. And while the FDA may be reviewing its safety now, more than 100 studies over the years have deemed mifepristone safe to use when ending a pregnancy. While many states have clamped down on abortion with bans and restrictions since the fall of Roe v. Wade, others like New York have worked to increase access and protect doctors prescribing mifepristone online. So to mark the anniversary today, we're going to touch on a little of all of this. To start, WAMC's Samantha Simmons spoke with a mother who not only used mifepristone for her own abortion, but vlogged it to help others learn about the experience.
First pill that you take, it's just going to be pretty tame. You know, it just like dilates you a little bit. You're supposed to take it 24 hours before you take the other pills. Put the name on the screen. I cannot pronounce it. Now here after I take that first
Marissa pill, Sunny Rudd is a content creator and founder of For the Family, an online resource for parents in New York City.
I had ordered the medication through a telehealth appointment. I met with a provider through a telehealth appointment, and then they prescribed that medication. It was mailed to my home. And when I told my mom that, she was really surprised, because when she had her miscarriage, that procedure for her was a lot more complex. And it was around the same timeline. So she was like, wow, things have really changed. Things were not like this in my day. And my mom is only 20 years older than me. I'm 31 right now. So she is 50. She'll be 51 this year. But yeah, even she's a pretty young mom too. And even for her in her lifetime, she didn't have access to that same care.
Has she ever mentioned how your life or her life would have been different if she had she had a miscarriage? And then did she have an abortion to remove that fetus, or did she pass it herself?
She did. Wow. Yeah. So she had to have an abortion to remove that fetus. So she needed medical support. And it was pretty early in her term. She and even then she was saying that, wow, this is so much simpler than the options that I was given when I was going through a similar experience. I think that we made that choice for different reasons, but my mom has always been very supportive and she supported my choice. And I think that she's really proud of the conviction with which I made that choice. And whether I choose to have a child, I do have a baby. I have a 3-year-old now. Whether I'm choosing to have an abortion, I feel like she supports me either way.
Mifepristone has been used safely by millions of Americans, people I know, people you know, you included. So this is obviously an incredibly hard decision to make, no matter, you know, what situation you're in. Can you tell us about your decision to receive a medication abortion?
I think I also want to note that sometimes it's a pretty easy decision for someone to make. And I think that the accessibility of mifepristone like directly determines how easy their experience can be, right? The more access they have to the medication, maybe the more easy an experience they might have. Now, if you are having kind of personal emotional conflict, everyone is different. For me, when I was pregnant, it wasn't that I don't love children. I do want a big family one day. I do have a 3-year-old now. At the time, I had a 1.5-year-old going on 2-year-old, and I was a single mom. So without that guarantee of having a co-parent, I had already experienced single motherhood. That just wasn't something that I wanted to commit my time and life to again. So one child is very different from two children, and that experience of motherhood is very different. So I think that I was grieving my situation more than I was grieving the abortion, right? I don't regret anything. And I think that shame, I don't feel guilt for having that abortion. I feel like guilt is different from grief. I was grieving, but I would not say that I felt guilty. So the decision to have an abortion was actually pretty easy for me. I was like, no, this is what I want to do. And luckily, I had access to the care that made it as simple as possible.
You have a young child, a 3-year-old. You were able to make the choice to not expand your family right then and there when you were pregnant again. How was your life impacted by being able to make that choice and have that decision available at your hands, and you didn't have to jump through maybe a million hoops that other people in other states have to jump through these days?
I think that it had an overwhelmingly positive effect on my life. I think that the choice to have an abortion gave me the opportunity to focus on the child that I had, and she gets that undivided attention from me. And also, I can channel my financial resources into her. So she has everything that she needs. She can do the special things that she wants to do. Also, I think it was the safest choice for my body. Because during my first pregnancy, when I gave birth, I almost died. And that was because I had Bandel's ring. That's something that I will likely have due to statistics for my next pregnancy if I ever choose to give birth again. And I was not willing to have a life-risking experience when I'm the only parent of this child who needs an active parent. So it was not worth risking my life at the time to do that. I think it was the best decision. I had a positive impact on my health. My career took off after that because I was really committed to every choice that I made after that. And the access of care, because it was not fully simple. I'm somebody who really locks in if I need to get something done, but it wasn't super simple. I did have to contact a lot of different organizations to find out who would take my insurance, how much time I had, when I could schedule those appointments. And I did kind of get the runaround for a bit. It took me maybe a day and a half of just constant reaching out to different organizations to find a provider who would accept my insurance. And that was after already being a reproductive health advocate. I had already been a content creator at that point, and I had done different contracts, different collaborations with reproductive organizations. And so I felt like I had the knowledge about mifepristone and about the abortion medication. I knew that it was an option for me. And not everybody knows that that's an option. So I knew exactly what I was looking for. And it still took me about a day and a half to find a provider that would take my insurance.
And can we talk a little bit more about using your platform to educate people about reproductive health care options? So, how did you get started in that? And what have your conversations with your followers or even people who just come across your account in passing been like?
I started as a content creator blogging or vlogging my first pregnancy, actually. And when I was going through my first pregnancy, I really took advantage of the WIC program, the Women, Infant, and Children's program. And a lot of people I learned online don't know that you can qualify for the WIC program while you're pregnant. So there is a whole package of pregnancy benefits that you get. So that's how I built my network of moms. And statistically, the people who are having abortions, who are choosing that route, a lot of them already have one child. So that's just how the statistics have shifted. So now I have reproductive health organizations reaching out to me because a lot of my followers are moms, they're other parents, and that information needs to be accessible to them if they do want to make a different choice. I also talk about domestic violence sometimes on my page. That's something that I experienced. And sometimes when you're in the thick of those conversations, about domestic violence, if you do find yourself pregnant and you need to leave that relationship, then that's a choice that you should be able to make to protect yourself and maybe any children that you have. So yeah, I talk about all of those things on my page. I'm happy to talk about reproductive health. I believe in the right to abortion. I believe that people should be able to access abortion, which is different because of, abortion bans and the current administration. Yeah, I'd like to talk about those things.
I just want to back up you talking about domestic violence. Sometimes people end up in situations where they, are pregnant and think, I can't leave this because I am pregnant or I already have children or it's just not safe for them. So having access to be able to, if you, are currently pregnant and able to get a medication abortion is something that can help out more than just in sense of family planning. It can help keep people safe in other ways too.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that it's really important that content creators talk about those things because abortion is a topic that people don't go looking for information for freely, at least the large majority of the population, from what I've learned. So if you do just happen to come across it on social media, maybe that's something that you'll stay to learn more about because it found you. And I think that that's really special too.
I think when we look at content creators, we're usually thinking about day in my life vlogs, and they always look so perfect. And you're like, oh man, I wish I could have that life. I wish I could, willingly eat a bowl of oatmeal every single day with berries in it. I don't know about you, but I'm not gonna do that. but so you're talking about your vlogs, and that it's not all about the pretty stuff in life or the things that you are, trying to reach. You want to reach a little bit of a different audience. Can you talk about that?
And I think it's not always about the pretty stuff in life. People are not always going through the best day of their life. Sometimes it's the hardest day of your life. And that's okay too, because I think that there's beauty and power in that as well. You talked about like the vlog, like day in my life. That was actually my abortion vlog that did numbers, because the opening line, I was like, have an abortion with me. So all I had to do was now go through the process, go through the movements of my day, which for me is a little bit easier than battling the psychological wall before you just have to take the medication. And I think that's where a lot of people either go back and forth or get stuck or get scared because there's a lot of misinformation out there about mifepristone and about the experience of what that might be like. Also, there's a lot of misinformation about abortion bans and whether or not you have access to that care. So you do have access to mifepristone in all 50 states, and there are shield laws in place in states that have providers who will prescribe that medication, and they can mail it to you in all 50 states. I think that that's important to know. And a lot of the time, people comment on my post and they'll be like, oh, what's it like to live in a state where you can even have an abortion? We have abortion bans in my state. And I'm like, ah, but there are shield laws in other states. So It's an interesting field, interesting conversations, because it really is just about what you know. Do you know your rights? Do you know about what you do have access to? Because I think that abortion bans are just there to scare you into thinking that you do not have access.
That was WAMC's Samantha Simmons speaking with Marissa Rudd of For the Family, an online resource for families in New York City. As Marissa mentioned, New York is one of several states to pass so-called shield laws protecting abortion providers from out-of-state lawsuits, and New York's law is being put to the test. Late last year, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed a civil lawsuit against Dr. Margaret Carpenter of New Paltz, New York, for prescribing abortion pills to a patient in Texas via telehealth. Texas bans nearly all abortions. When Carpenter failed to respond to the case, as per New York's law, a Texas judge hit her with more than $100,000 in fines. But that still hasn't been carried out, again, in accordance with New York's shield law. Recently, Paxton filed another lawsuit against the Ulster County Clerk, Taylor Brook, for refusing to file that ruling in New York.
Since everything that the doctor did was legal in New York State, she never left New York State. Our interpretation of the shield law made it pretty clear that we were not to comply with it.
That lawsuit is not the only case out there involving Carpenter. She also faces criminal charges for prescribing pills in Louisiana. It's also not the only case involving mifepristone. To learn more about the current legal landscape for the drug, I spoke with Kimberly Mutcherson, a reproductive justice scholar and professor of law at Rutgers Law School in New Jersey.
So I will talk first about the folks who are challenging access, but then I also want to just make the point that there are a couple lawsuits that are still out there that are about expanding access to mifepristone. So there's sort of competing interests out in the courts right now.
Okay.
So as you said, So it's a really interesting. If you're sort of a law nerd, it's a really interesting time to see all the different ways that people are dealing with questions of abortion post-Dobbs. It's long been a very rocky landscape when it comes to abortion access, and it's only become more so since Dobbs, including in federal courts, which is super interesting because the Supreme Court basically said, you know, let's get the Supreme Court out of these issues, and yet they're going to continue to have cases probably for the next several terms that deal with abortion access. So as you said, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine ultimately wound its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, we don't even have to think about the merits of this case. We're going to decide that we can't decide the case because the people who are the plaintiffs here really don't have sufficient interest in mifepristone to make them viable plaintiffs, right? So it was just a sort of collection of physicians who didn't prescribe mifepristone, who didn't treat patients who had taken mifepristone. So it made no sense that they were the ones who were challenging access to the drug. So the Supreme Court said, we're not interested in that, and sent them on their way. At the same time that all these things were going on, there were also some states who had an eye on the fact that there were probably going to be some standing issues for the folks from Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. And so there were several states who decided that they were going to take up that mantle if Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine couldn't carry it. And that's exactly what happened. So Missouri and a couple of other states decided that they were going to make essentially the same claims. And the claims are that the FDA's process to initially put mifepristone on the market and to approve it for sale in the United States and dispensing in the United States, that should never have happened, that it was a flawed process, that they didn't have enough data, so on and so on. So now we have the same sorts of arguments that are being made in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine that are now being made by some states, although the question of whether those states actually have sufficient interest to be bringing that claim is also up in the air. So it may be that we see that lawsuit get kicked on the question of standing as well. So that's one case that is ongoing, and that one's called Missouri versus FDA, but it's not just Missouri. There are a couple other states that are involved as well. And right now, and this may be interesting to you, right now the Justice Department has actually taken the position that these states do not have sufficient interest in mifepristone and it's and how it's dispensed and whether it was approved by the FDA to be able to continue to pursue this litigation. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out in federal court, especially if it ends up at the Supreme Court, which has been, I would say, very generous to the Trump administration in some ways so far. So that's one set of litigation. There are also a couple of cases that have been filed that are trying to basically keep the courts from deciding that mifepristone can't be dispensed. And so Gen BioPro, which is the company that produces generic mifepristone, has a piece of litigation going on right now that came out of West Virginia. And they are basically saying that because the FDA has approved mifepristone, that states that ban access to abortion are actually preempted from doing so because the FDA has already approved mifepristone. That's not a great case, and the reason why it's not a great case is because mifepristone is only one way to get an abortion, so it doesn't really make sense to make the claim that a state can't ban abortion because they're not banning mifepristone, right? They're doing this sort of broad-based attack on abortion access. So that case, I think, is not really particularly useful in this context, but that's another one that folks have filed, and that's a federal case as well. Then there's a state case that arises from Louisiana's decision to decide that mifepristone should be labeled as a dangerous controlled substance, which has really significant ways of restricting access to mifepristone. So that's a state court case, and there are some birth workers and some medical professionals who are challenging Louisiana deciding to categorize mifepristone as a controlled substance. Mm-hmm. And that case is ongoing, and we're going to see how that plays itself out. And then I should also say, as I said, there are some pieces of litigation, some of which have been going on since, 2017, mm-hmm. That are actually trying to ensure access to mifepristone. So let's see, there was a case out of Washington State, but that one got dismissed. But there are still cases, one that's coming out of Virginia, one that's coming out of Hawaii. And these are federal cases where you have people who are proponents of abortion access who are saying that all of the existing rules and regulations that make it harder to access mifepristone than it should be, that all of those should be dispensed with. So we have sort of two competing buckets of litigation going on. One bucket is that FDA is already making it too hard to access mifepristone, and so they should take away some of these unnecessary requirements. And then the other side, you have people who are opposed to abortion also litigating, saying the FDA never should have approved abortion in the first instance, should never have approved mifepristone in the first instance. And if they are going to leave it on the market, they should have all sorts of regulations in order for people to have access to it. So those are the two litigation buckets. But then there's another way that people can go after mifepristone, which is to go straight to the FDA.
Yeah.
And so there's this process, the citizen petition process, and there are multiple citizen petitions that are now sitting with the FDA. And just as there are two buckets of litigation, there are two buckets of citizen petitions. So on one side, we've got about 20 states that have a citizen petition that is all about making sure that mifepristone stays on the market, but also about removing the excess requirements for accessing mifepristone. So that's one citizen petition. There's another citizen petition that is urging the FDA to not make any changes to access to mifepristone unless and until there are actually high-quality, peer-reviewed scientific studies that suggest that there is actually some sort of problem with mifepristone, that it's dangerous, that it should be on the market, that it should be regulated in a different way. And the truth of the matter is there will be no such studies. It's just mifepristone has been on the market for a very long time. It has been studied and researched over and over and over again. We know that it is safe. So that citizen petition is saying, leave mifepristone alone and, in fact, make it more accessible than it has been. And then there's another citizen petition that's pending with the FDA right now that is saying, again, sort of in the same vein as Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, this never should have been on the market. The FDA never should have approved it. The FDA should, remove it from the market and then
go through a new process to decide whether it should be approved. So all of that is to say that mifepristone continues to be at the center of a lot of advocacy, both from pro-choice advocates and from anti-choice advocates. And in large part, that is because what has become so clear post-Dobbs is that medication abortion is absolutely central to abortion access in the United States. It's central. And so if folks who are anti-choice can get mifepristone off the market, that causes enormous amounts of disruption around the entire country, which, of course, is in some ways a better strategy than just going state by state, right? If you can get it off the market altogether, then nobody's going to have access to it.
I did see reports recently that Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr., I guess, has reportedly told some states that the FDA is reviewing the drug's, I guess, quote, safety and efficacy. What does that mean here? Could that have an impact?
Yeah, so that's huge. So one of the conversations that I was having with folks after Trump got elected for the second time was that once you have control of the FDA, in some ways, you don't really need litigation anymore. All you need is somebody who's the head of the FDA who's willing to sort of make what I would describe as a political choice, that access to mifepristone should be either more difficult or that mifepristone should be withdrawn from the market altogether. And so once RFK Jr. Was sitting at HHS, I was just sort of waiting for what that was going to look like, because it's clear that that is something that was going to happen. And basically it happened because an anti-choice organization released I'm not even going to call it a study, because nothing about it is what we would think of as an actually substantive, peer-reviewed scientific study. But they released this quote-unquote study in which they claimed that there are all sorts of health issues that come from the use of mifepristone that haven't been properly documented and haven't been properly studied. So they release this study, and the purpose of that, quite frankly, was to give RFK Jr. and the FDA an opportunity to say, oh, wait, now we've got this new data, and this new data makes us think that we need to go back and review everything that was done in order to decide to approve mifepristone in the first instance. So the FDA can certainly decide, without litigation at all, the FDA can certainly decide, oh, now that we're looking back at these studies and this process that we went through, it was an inadequate process. And so as an agency, we need to do better, and we want to take mifepristone off the market. We want to take away the approval that was given to mifepristone so that we can, you know, quote unquote, do more studies. Everything about that is farcical. But that's sort of where we are in the world right now, that you would decide that one study released by a bunch of people who did not get it peer-reviewed and published is sufficient to take a drug off the market that has been literally studied and dispensed for decades. But that's the world we live in right now.
Kimberly Mutcherson is a reproductive justice scholar and professor of law at Rutgers Law School, where she was also the first woman co-dean in the school's history. You can learn more about her work at law.rutgers.edu. Kimberly, thanks so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The night air down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.